So we're having a series on the city, and I thought I'd be interested to look back in time at the role of cities at the beginning of Buddhism and whether there's any message, useful message in that for practicing Buddhism in the city today, which may or may not be. I'm not quite sure yet whether there will be. But when the Buddha was around, it was a period in the northeast of India where he was based in the Ganges Basin, known as the Second Urbanization. In India. And the reason it was the second urbanization is because that there was an earlier urbanization in India, and it was one of the three great early old world civilizations. So in 2500 BC, a civilization of cities appeared in the valley, not of the Ganges, but of the Indus River. And the Indus River is one of the great rivers of India that flows down through Pakistan and into northwestern India. And when the British were building railways there in the late 19th century, they were looking for ballast to lay under the tracks, and they found this wonderful source of these beautiful regular bricks. And so they got their shovels out, and they shoveled these bricks. And sooner or later, some archaeologists got interested, had a look, and discovered that these bricks were coming from these very, very ancient cities. I think the first one to be found was called Mohenjo-Daro, and Mohenjo-Daro means the mound of the dead. That was the local name that had been given, so people must have realized it was an old city. But by this time, in the arid plains around the Indus, it was just a mound of old bricks. And they excavated, and they found in Mohenjo-Daro, Harappa was another big one, and they found quite a few cities. They found 70 already, 70 cities. Isn't that incredible? Down the banks of the Indus River. Mohenjo-Daro itself was a city of 40,000 people. Very, very sophisticated. It had a sewage system. It had no palace. It had no church. It had no centre. It had no weapons. It had no evidence of violence there, according to Mortimer Wheeler at least. It had a large bath. On a hill in the middle. It had tablets with writing on, which nobody can read. Even 100 years later, still nobody can read these tablets. They don't know what they say. It had sculptures, quite sophisticated sculptures.
What period would it be?
2,500 BC. So 4,500 years ago. So it's roughly the same time as the cities were being built in Egypt. And the cities were being built in Iraq, in Mesopotamia. Those were the three great centres of old world civilization, of very ancient civilization. And the Indus Valley seems to have been the largest. It certainly covered the largest area, and it may have had the largest population, perhaps about 10 million people, which doesn't sound a lot nowadays, but in those days that was a lot of people. And something happened, and nobody knows what happened. It may have been drought, it may have been human-induced climate change, at least locally, because of poor management of the land and so on. Maybe around 1800 BC or something, the cities went into decline, and they became ruins. But they were obviously known. They were known in the rest of India, not just because people called the place the Mound of the Dead, but they seem to have been known still at the time of the Buddha. And this is the time of the second great urbanization. There weren't any large cities just 100 or 200 years before the time of the Buddha. There were towns, but there were no large cities. But there became another period where people started building cities. Again, not quite sure why that should be. And so when the Buddha was alive, he was born in a small city of about 8,000 people in the foothills of the Himalayas. But there were some very big cities around, and in fact, at the time, they list six particular large conurbations. But now, over the other side, in the valley of the Ganges, the Gangetic Plain, it's known as, in northeastern India. I think that's in modern Bihar, Bengal, that sort of area, isn't it? And in between the cities, it was jungle. A lot of it was jungle. Very, very dense jungle. And so if you imagine living in those days, if you wanted to travel, presumably most people probably would not travel, but if you were the Buddha, you did want to travel. And you had to go down these tracks through these dark jungles for many miles, like hundreds of miles, you know, long, long journeys. And then at the end of that track, you would see, maybe on the horizon, lit by the sun, this amazing sight of a beautiful walled city with spires and turrets and high buildings and lakes around it, parks around it and so on as well. And for people in those days, the city was a very, very positive thing. They thought it was wonderful. And so the image you get of the city in the Buddhist scriptures is a very positive image on the whole. I don't mean that they didn't have some of the problems we have with cities, they did. But on the whole, it was seen as something wonderful, magical. And I have the sense it's partly because of that sense of the difficult travel through the wild jungle, infested with tigers, infested with bandits, infested with mosquitoes, and even infested with demons, because there was a strong sense there that the wilderness was a dangerous place. It was psychically dangerous as well as physically dangerous. And people regarded as very courageous if they could travel through it. But there were trade routes as well, and it was a time of merchants. It was a time of travelling, and maybe the merchants may have had a role in the increasing prosperity of cities. You need prosperity to be able to build cities. There are a number of other theories about it. One of the main ones is to do with the cultivation of rice. Once they discovered the cultivation of rice, which is about this period, the productivity of the land really went up, and it also needed a lot of organisation because it needs irrigation. It's quite labour intensive to harvest it, but it did mean that you could support these urban populations of specialists. So the Buddha, during his lifetime, before his enlightenment and after, was walking these trade routes, was walking these tracks through the forest, was travelling from place to place, travelling normally from city to city. And very often it would be, he would stop for a while, maybe for the whole rainy season, when he got to a city. Now, I could give a whole lecture on this area of Buddhism and urbanisation, because it's something that sort of the archaeologists and so on have been, and historians have been really fascinated by. And there was a sort of a thesis a while ago, going back to Max Müller and other people like that, that had the idea that Buddhism and urbanisation were closely related to each other, and that Buddhism, in fact, was a product of urbanisation. But there's been more recent work on this that has really called this rather into question. I always felt a bit suspicious of the idea myself as well. Certainly they were happening about the same time, and they were certainly responding to each other, but I think it's a gross oversimplification that says that the Buddha was a product of this new urban culture. And you can see this by the way that the scholars all completely contradict each other. First of all, they have four broad reasons why they think this was, and then they come to opposite conclusions from it. So the first one is to do with merchants. So because there's this new merchant class, the merchants weren't really recognised by the old Brahmin priesthood. The Brahmins thought of themselves as being the top of Indian society. They would teach everybody this. They were the priests conducting the sacrifices. They were also cattle owners, landowners very often, village headmen, all that kind of thing. And they despised cities. And so even in more recent times, Hinduism has often had quite a jaundiced view of cities. Even Gandhi, for example, was very much in favour of sort of going back to the land and so on. But anyway, let's go back again to the Buddha's time. And so the suggestion was that this new merchant class needed spirituality, you know, and it wasn't being offered by the Brahmins, who weren't interested in them. They weren't, the Brahmins were very, very traditionalist, and merchants weren't really there in the tradition very much. And so maybe that's why a new religion might be needed. But then other people will say the opposite. They'll say, oh no, Buddhism was a reaction against the consumerism, the materialism that was coming about nowadays is with this newfound prosperity. And people were opposing it. And that was why that Buddhism arose. Another reason that's given is to do with just the nature of city life itself. And the suggestion there is that city life needed sort of legitimizing, because the Brahmins were opposed to it, that people needed to sort of new cultural norms that were used to city life. And maybe Buddhism was coming in that way, helping people to learn how to live together in a city. And then other people say, no, Buddhism was to do with getting away from the city, going on retreat, living as a monk, wandering in the countryside, and avoiding the problems of the city. Other people will talk about centralized political organization, because again, from very small states, India was becoming more and more dominated by large monarchies, with very powerful kings, with very big capital cities. And so you have these new political organizations. And the Buddha befriended kings. He advised them and so on. He didn't necessarily oppose them. And other people will say the opposite and say that actually Buddhism was, although he did befriend kings, it was mainly a more revolutionary movement. It was opposing the caste system. It was organized in an anarchical way. It was in a way quite subversive as a movement in those days. And then the final one that's mentioned sometimes is to do with the growth in agrarian culture. In other words, the farming methods. Because when the Indo-Aryans arrived in India, they were pastoralists, they were herdsmen, they carried herds of sheep and cattle and that kind of thing. But as people settled down, started growing rice and so on, things changed. And so the suggestion is there again that was associated with Buddhism, because Buddhism was in a way opposed to things like animal sacrifice, other things associated with the ownership of cattle. It was very much espousing people to look after animals properly, and therefore maybe it was more suitable for the farmers. But alternatively, people say no, it's to do with a return to nature, and people were really appreciating the jungle and the wild places. You know, so I just wanted to give you an idea. This is what scholars do, of course. Now, I don't know who's right, but there's a lot of debate about it. But anyway, early Buddhism is associated with urbanization. But in a way, I think maybe the main point I would say is that the suggestion that a lot of these people made is that city living was angst-ridden. It was really tough. It was really stressful. And so this is what the Buddha was dealing with. But I don't think that's true. When the Buddha talks about dukkha, he's not specifying urban dukkha only. He's saying that everybody, whether you're a hunter in the forest, whether you're a farmer, whether you're a poor fisherman, whether you're living in the city, whether you're a king or whether you're a slave, all these people were having to face the dukkha of old age, sickness and death and loss and all that kind of thing. Everyone had to face that, and he wanted to deal with that. So I do think that Buddhism is not specifically urban. But having said that, the rest of what I wanted to talk about today was some of the connections that are made by the Buddha and early Buddhism with cities, because I find it very interesting. And in particular, I want to start with something that Bodhilila mentioned Buddha Day, and the talk I gave on Buddha Day, I mentioned this image that the Buddha uses when he tries to describe what it was like for him to become enlightened and what it was like for him to decide to found Buddhism. And the image he used was of the ancient track to the ruined city. So you may have heard this. So I thought I'd actually read you, it's a little bit abbreviated, but I thought I'd read you the actual text from the Pali Canon. So this is 2,500 years old. It's called the Nagara Sutta. Nagara means a city. So this is what he's saying. He's describing the experience to his disciples. And he says, before my awakening, when I was just an unawakened bodhisattva, the realization came to me how this world has fallen on difficulty. It's born, it ages, it dies, it falls away, and then it re-arises. But it doesn't discern the escape from this stress, from this dukkha, from this aging and death. Oh, when will it discern the escape from this stress, from this aging and death? And then he describes his realization of the process that you see on the outer rim of the Wheel of Life, the 12 nidanas, the chain of links that result in dukkha, in suffering, and go round and round in circles, starting from ignorance, leading to suffering, then ignorance again leading to suffering. So he describes this discovery during his meditation. And then he says that if you can work backwards through these links, this is the cessation of the entire mass of dukkha, of suffering. Cessation. Cessation, he says. Vision arose. Clear knowing arose. Discernment arose. Knowledge arose. Illumination arose within me with regard to things never heard before. So he's saying that this, at least as far as he was concerned, this was new, this discovery he'd made about how dukkha, how suffering originates. And then he gives his image. He says, it's just as if a man travelling along a wilderness track were to see an ancient path, an ancient road travelled by people of former times. He would follow it. Following it, he'd see an ancient city, an ancient capital inhabited by people of former times, complete with parks and groves and ponds, walled, delightful. He would go to address the king or the prime minister, saying, "Sire, you should know that while I was travelling along a wilderness track, I saw an ancient path, I followed it, I saw an ancient city. Delightful. Sire, rebuild that city." And the king or the prime minister would rebuild the city so that at a later time the city would become powerful, rich, well populated, fully grown and prosperous. And the Buddha carries on. In the same way, I saw an ancient path, an ancient road, travelled by the rightly self-awakened ones of former times, the enlightened ones of former times. And what is that ancient path, that ancient road, travelled by rightly self-awakened ones of former times? It's just the Noble Eightfold Path. I followed that path, and following it, I came to direct knowledge of aging and death, direct knowledge of the origination of aging and death, direct knowledge of the cessation of aging and death, in other words, how to stop suffering, direct knowledge of the path that leads to the cessation of aging and death. And I followed that path. Following it, I came to direct knowledge of birth and becoming and clinging and craving and feeling, contact, the six sense media, name and form, and consciousness. And following that, sorry, knowing that directly, I have revealed it to monks, to nuns, to male lay followers, and to female lay followers, so that this spiritual life has become powerful, rich, detailed, well populated, well widespread, proclaimed among celestial and human beings. So that's quite interesting, isn't it? I think that the use of the sophistication of the image in a way. And why did he choose that? Why did he choose that image? I think there's quite a lot that one could say about what it sort of conveys. I mean, the first thing about it, in a way, the obvious thing is that the image has got two elements, a path and a city that you get to. And that's quite interesting. So he discovered two things. He discovered an ancient track, and then he follows the ancient track and he gets to an ancient city. And then we have to ask, well, what is the track? Well, he says what the track is. It's the Noble Eightfold Path, or it's the path to the end of suffering. But what exactly is the city? And he says it's a rediscovery. That's interesting as well, isn't it? The Buddha always used to say this. He used to always say, look, people have done this before, but it's been forgotten about. So he felt he was making a discovery without direct help, but he never claimed to be completely original. He says, no, there have been Buddhas before. And that there's been a lot of speculation about what he was thinking about there. Does that mean historical? Does that mean he was aware of great sages from former times? Interestingly, going back to Mahanjodhara, one of the little seals there appears to show a man meditating. And of course, people have read a lot into that, but nobody can read the writing, so maybe it's just they all sat cross-legged, you know, who knows? But it does seem to be, it seemed to have a spiritual significance, this image. So maybe there were people in those old cities who led sophisticated spiritual lives, who were, from a Buddhist point of view, enlightened, who were wise or compassionate or whatever. Maybe it was people in ancient Iran. There's going a little, not quite that far back, but to Iran a few hundred years before, where you did have the origins of Zoroastrianism and some very great spiritual teachers. Who knows? Maybe he's thinking in more mythic terms, that this is always something that is available. So the path, he says, is twofold here. I mentioned he says it's the Noble Eightfold Path, which is a positive image of the path. He also says it's the path of how you make this process stop that is leading to dukkha, the process described on the outer rim of the Wheel of Life. So that's a more negative way of looking at it. And what's the city then? Well, the city is the knowledge, is the direct knowledge that he arrived at through this enlightenment process, according to the image. But it's also the whole spiritual life which he restored. In other words, it's Buddhism. So the city itself is the Buddha's image for the Buddhism that he founded. And the population of the city, therefore, is the Sangha. So you could even say you've got the three jewels there. You've got the Dharma as the path, the Buddha as the city itself, or enlightenment as the city, and the population of the city as being the Sangha. And he describes this restored spiritual life. So just going back again to the image, I love the beginning of it, because the beginning of it is being lost. Is being lost in the jungle, really, isn't it? Not knowing where you are. Quite frightening, in a way. And an image for what life can be like that sometimes, where you feel you just don't really know where you're going. You may have lost your sense of direction. You may even feel that the whole world is a jungle, that you're always going to be just wandering around in a jungle without much meaning. So if you were in that situation, to find an old trackway would be really exciting. Your spirits would really be lifted, I think, by it. You think, oh, blimey, God, I wonder where this goes. You know, you really be. And some of the translations actually say, they don't say through a wilderness, they say over a mountain ridge. I don't know why there should be those different translations, but I have that sense, again, of the track going up and maybe opening out. So instead of being in the dark jungle, you get a view, you get a bit of a vista, perhaps. So it's a path that leads somewhere, but a place that needs to be restored, though. And the other thing about the city, as I see it, and I'll say more later about why I see it this way, is the city is a mandala. The cities were usually circular or hexagonal or sometimes square, but they were symmetrical. And usually, unlike Mohenjo-daro, they had a citadel at the centre or a palace at the centre where the ruler of the city would live. So they're very like a mandala. In fact, the mandala image, the image of the circular symmetrical form that's so common in Buddhism, is partly based on the plan of a city or the plan of a palace, with a wall around it with gates on each side, normally four gates, and with that central point. And you'll see later how the ruler of the city becomes the teacher of the Dharma in later city imagery. I hope I've got time to go into that as well. So it's a beautiful mandala, or a Buddha field, a pure Buddha field is the other image that's used for this sometimes. So when the Buddha discovers the city, you know, he might just settle there and think, oh, this is nice, let's stay here, we've got water here, haven't we? You know, I can get some stuff from the forest, this will be nice, I'll just live in one of the nice little old ruined houses. But he doesn't. He goes back, he says, let's restore it. And that's quite a shift, because it's a shift from an individual process to a collective process. No one person can restore a city. You've got to get the government involved. So that's why he goes to see the king or the prime minister. He wants to get the government involved. He says, this is part of our legacy, of our land, you know, this city. It was once our capital, he says, a former capital of men of former times, he says. Let's bring it back to its former glory. So I think that this represents an aspect of his project whereby it's even said sometimes that, you know, he was quite tempted at the beginning just to enjoy the fact he was enlightened and didn't have any problems anymore, didn't have any negative emotion, wasn't bothered about anything. And he thought, well, this is nice, isn't it? Let's sit around and enjoy life. But he decided, no, I'm going to go back. I'm going to go back and I'm going to meet with society. I'm going to get society involved. I'm going to establish something. Very experimental at first. I don't think he knew how he was going to do it, but at least he'd try and see if he could communicate his vision, his enlightenment to other people as best he could. And I think this brings in the Bodhisattva ideal, the altruistic ideal of Buddhism, which is found in all branches of Buddhism, I should say. So he's calling on something large. He's calling on larger resources. In bringing the king involved. And you could say, in a way, maybe he was calling on larger resources in himself in making the shift from being just a sage who meditated and got enlightened to being a teacher who wanted to found a new system, a new movement. The ordinary human historical Buddha perhaps wasn't strong enough to restore the city. He had to call on sort of an archetypal grander Buddha, which again is a figure that becomes much more prominent in later Buddhism. And for us personally, I think there's something in this, I find at least for me, that just having a well-sorted out personal practice is not enough. I mean, it's very impressive if you can do that, if you can sort out your life so that you're reasonably well-balanced, you're maybe making use of meditation and mindfulness, and it's keeping you in good relationship with other people. I mean, that is great. I think that is fantastic. It's a wonderful achievement. I don't want to denigrate it in any way. But I think most of us need also some sort of a project, a creative project of some kind. I don't think it's enough just to be sorted out. I think after a while you'll realise, well, okay, things are all right, I can get on with people all right, but so what, you know. So I think that in a way, like that man discovering the ruins and thinking, let's restore it, let's go for that, in a way we need to make a discovery of that nature, I think. And I don't know what that's going to be. It's going to be different for every person. It may not be connected with Buddhism, it might be connected with the arts, it might be connected with setting up a business, it might be connected with raising a family, you know, but it'll be a project that takes you out of your own immediate self-interest. And I think there are two aspects of this project that make it bigger than oneself. One of them is that it has an altruistic base, that it's not just to do with your own interests, it's to do with others in some way or another. And the other is that it's cooperative. Again, this is not for absolutely everybody, but I think there are very few people that can be alone genius. I think we need to do things cooperatively, which is really, as we're finding here, it's really challenging when you've got a big project like our new Buddhist centre. You've got to learn to cooperate with each other, but you see things in different ways sometimes. So it's a very, very productive challenge, I think, to be not just wanting something big to happen, but wanting to do it in a cooperative spirit. So I think it's a good question to ask yourself, you know, do you feel you have such a project? You know, or if you're not quite sure, well, what might it be? You know, and I think it's good to sort of have a sense of that. It might be in the future. You know, it might not be now. You might be doing things now that are preparatory, that are training. You know, like if you're a student, that's an obvious one, isn't it? And the other interesting thing about the rebuilding of the city, it seems to me, is that it never ceases. You never finish restoring a city. I mean, because the city is falling into ruins at the same time as you're busy on one end, but the other end is falling into ruins. And anyway, you get fed up with it, don't you? And there's that old skyscraper and it's still standing, but it's so ugly, you want to get rid of that. So in a way, the same goes for one's own project, I think. It shouldn't be a project that has an end. It needs to be something which you will never finish. You'll never complete. And it's interesting, of course there are individual small-scale projects, like putting on a play, for example, which at some point you get to the culmination of it, and at some point it finishes its run. So in a sense you finish that individual project. But I think that one's life project needs to be something more than just having something. Okay, I'm Dr. Johnson, I'll write a dictionary, finish my dictionary, oh good, I can retire now. Anyway, you don't want to do that, you want to carry on with something. But nevertheless, the unfinished city should be beautiful and harmonious. You don't want to be constantly living in a building site. So again, the project that one's undertaking needs to be satisfying as it is at the moment, I think. It needs to be satisfying as you do it, not just, oh God, slog, 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 one day we'll be finished, and then, thank goodness, I can leave and get out of it. Yes. So I think this is why the Buddha used this system quite often, where he would use an imaginative narrative, a story, an explanation from his own life, but like this one, maybe just an imagined story, in order to engage people and to in a way give them an indication of what he was suggesting, beyond just saying the Noble Eightfold Path is one perfect vision, two perfect emotion, and so on. That is conceptual, maybe very useful. You can maybe memorise it, but you need something to grab your imagination. And I think that story of the city is something along those lines, I think. And then still, outside the city, is the jungle. And we need to go there sometimes as well, I think. Now, the second example I wanted to give I hope this isn't too much, but I wanted to go a bit further forward in Buddhism, a few hundred years, to the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, which, well, this particular part of this one is probably about 500 years after the time of the Buddha. It's not quite known, but it's ascribed to the Buddha. And it's a similar, but interestingly different, story of a city. And this is a city which is given a name, unlike the ruined city. The name of the city is Gandakuti, which means something like the fragrant place. Ganda means fragrance, doesn't it?
Ganda.
Yes. Gandakuti, the fragrant place. The place of fragrances. And in this story, the hero of the story is a bodhisattva, which means a Buddhist hero, really. And the name of this Buddhist bodhisattva is rather unusual. His name is Always Crying. Sada Prarudita. Always Crying. Or Ever Weeping. And it's a long, very long story. It's in here. This is the Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 lines, or 8,000 shlokas, which is quite a lot in Sanskrit. And it's it's the culmination of the whole book. It's the last chapter of the book is this story. And the Bodhisattva Ever Weeping has a very strong mystical experience in which he has the strong sense that he needs to go and look for perfect wisdom. He must find perfect wisdom. He must do it. He's enormously inspired by this mystical experience. And the only clue he's got is that it's somewhere in the East, a little bit like for us in Europe, sometimes it was the mystic East. This is where you find it. So he starts trudging off in an easterly direction, looking for perfect wisdom. But after he's been travelling for a few days or weeks, not quite clear, he sort of slows down a bit, comes to a halt, and he realises, I've got absolutely no idea what I'm looking for or where it is. And he starts crying. That's his name. He starts weeping. He falls into despair. I shouldn't laugh, but he falls into despair. What can I do? He thinks, what can I do? And at this point, he has a vision of the Buddha. So he has a vision of the Buddha. He's a Buddhist, of course, as a bodhisattva. So he has a vision of the Buddha appearing before him and speaking to him. And so this is what it says. When Sada Prarudita, ever weeping, thus sorrowed and pined away, a vision of the Buddha suddenly stood before him. And the Buddha said, the Buddhas of the past, when they were bodhisattvas, have also searched for perfect wisdom in the same spirit in which you just now search for it. In this same spirit of vigour and determination, zeal and zest, go east, says the vision, go east. But there, 500 leagues away from here, there is a city. That city is called Gandavati. If I said Gandakuti, it's actually Gandavati, I got it wrong, yeah. The place of perfumes, Gandavati, the city of fragrances. It's 12 leagues long, it's 12 leagues broad, and it's enclosed by 7 walls. I'll start that again because there's a little visualization here where in detail the city is being described. Yeah, and this is a very common thing in the Mahayana Sutras where something is described very symmetrical and beautiful in detail. You're supposed to close your eyes and see if you can imagine it. So, it's 12 leagues long, 12 leagues round, and it's enclosed by 7 walls, 7 moats, and 7 rows of palm trees. It's prosperous, it's flourishing, it's secure from attack, it contains abundant provisions, and it's full of beasts and men. Men and women, of course. 500 streets of shops run through the town from one end to the other, beautiful to behold like a well-coloured painting, arranged one by one in regular succession, and in between the shops there are well-constructed sites and passages are erected, some of them for vehicles drawn by animals, some for palanquins, and some for pedestrians, so that there's plenty of room for everybody. The well-founded coping of the city walls slopes into the golden river Jambu. A network of small bells is fastened on strings, and this surrounds the entire city. When they are stirred by the wind, the small bells give out a sweet, charming, and delightful sound, just like the sound from a quintet played by the Gandharvas, who are celestial musicians. Gandharvas skilled in songs. And that music causes those beings to divert, enjoy, and amuse themselves. And I can't read out the whole thing, but so then it talks about the flower gardens, which contain flowers from all over the world, and parks outside the city walls with lotus ponds, which nobody sees as their private property, it says. And it says that above the lotus ponds there are the sounds of geese, cranes, ducks, curlews and other birds filling the air over the ponds. And there, in that city of Gandavati, at a place where four roads meet, is the house of the Bodhisattva Dharmodgata. One league all round, bright with the seven precious things, beautiful to behold, enclosed by seven walls and seven rows of palm trees. And then there's a description of the gardens of this house, and the lakes in the gardens, and all that sort of stuff. In the mansion lives the Bodhisattva Dharmodgata with his followers. He diverts, enjoys, and amuses himself. He feels and tastes the five kinds of sense pleasures. And all the inhabitants of the city, both the women and the men, divert, enjoy, and amuse themselves. And they have constant joy in the parks and sailing on the ponds. The Bodhisattva Dharmodgata, however, with his retinue, diverts, enjoys, and amuses himself only for a certain time. And then thereafter, he always demonstrates perfect wisdom. And then there's a long description of the beautiful teaching seat which the citizens build for the Bodhisattva Dharmodgata, who is the principal Buddhist teacher in the town, in the city, so that they can listen to perfect wisdom, and then they go away and they study it and they teach it themselves. And everyone in the city, as a result of this, has gained firm and deep realizations. Anyway, then remember we've got Ever Weeping listening to the vision of the Buddha describing the city to him, and the vision goes on. Ever Weeping, go to that Bodhisattva Dharmodgata. From him you will hear perfect wisdom. For he has been for a long time your good friend. He's summoned you. He's instigated and encouraged you to win full enlightenment. Also, he in the past searched for perfect wisdom in the same way in which you just now are searching for it. So go forth, go on day and night, giving your undivided attention to the task. Before long, you will hear the perfection of wisdom. So, and then after many, many adventures, including meeting a woman who becomes his partner in the, and finances the expedition, incidentally, because she's a merchant's daughter, merchant's coming back in again, the whole caravan that they take with them reach the city of Gandavati, and they listen to the teachings on perfect wisdom. And I don't think I've got time to tell you what those teachings are. They're very profound, to do with emptiness and so on. If there's time, I can do that. Isn't that interesting? I thought, at least. Isn't that interesting? It's if you're familiar with Mahayana literature, you'll know that often you get descriptions of pure lands. The most famous one is called Sukhavati. And in Sukhavati is very much a garden pure land, a garden or a park. But this is a city. And not only is it a city in an abstract sense, it's described in some detail. Even the Regent Street and the Oxford Street and the pedestrianised alleys between the shops. Isn't that interesting? You know? And the fact that the citizens are provided with continual music as well, that's interesting. I mean, there are lots of interesting things about it, isn't there? Maybe this is it. Maybe this is the city of the Buddha's vision, but now in a restored state, perhaps, because it comes in later Buddhism. But it also very strongly is a mandala. I mean, it's very strong, isn't it? It's got these circles around it. It's got a definite circular form. It's got this very strong centre. But instead of a palace at the centre, there is the house and the teaching platform of the guru, of the Buddhist teacher, forming the centre of this mandala, this city. There are lots of other uses of the city image in early Buddhism, and just one I'll mention. I don't know if I'm going to read this out, actually, it's too fast. But the city is often given as an image for oneself, for one's mind. And the Kimsuka Sutta goes into this, and it says it's like the mind. Your mind is like a king's border city. So a border city or a frontier city is a bit different, because that's a dangerous place and is well fortified, and it needs gates, and it needs watchmen, and it needs a garrison. A border city with strong walls and arches and with gates. And there is a wise, skilled and experienced gatekeeper. This is the Buddha speaking again, who keeps out the unknown and admits the known. And from the east there come a swift pair of messengers, and they say to the gatekeeper, "Where's the lord of the city?" And the gatekeeper says, "He's over there at the crossroads in the centre." Then the two messengers take a truthful report to the lord of the city, and they return the way they come. And likewise, two messengers come from the west, come from the south, and come from the north. And the Buddha goes, "I've given you a parable so that you can understand it. This is the explanation. The city is a name for your body, composed of the four great elements, born of mother and father, an accumulation of food, impermanent, subject to abrasion, dissolution and disintegration. The gates of a city denote the sense spheres. The gatekeeper is mindfulness. The two swift messengers are calm and insight meditation." Calmness meditation and insight meditation, yeah? "The lord of the city is your consciousness. The crossroads at the centre is the crossroads of the four great elements, the earth, the water, the fire and the air. The truthful report is awakening itself. And the way that they came is the Noble Eightfold Path." So there are a number of examples of this, where the city is given as an emblem for yourself, and the importance of its symmetry, of having awareness there at the centre of the city, and of also guarding what comes in and out through the senses. Guarding the gates of the senses is a very common phrase in Buddhism. So what I get from these is the city is a place that needs protecting, but it's also a place of enjoyment as well. And the Dhammagata legend is very much, very strongly emphasises having fun, doesn't it? And it just not just listening to music, but just enjoying yourself. If you like piped music. It's not piped, but it's very natural, because it's just the wind making the bells ring. So it sounds like a quintet of Gandharvas. But it says, do you remember what he says? He says he knows when to stop. So he enjoys and diverts himself for a certain length of time. And then he thinks, now it's time for the regulars class. And he starts teaching perfect wisdom. Not that they don't enjoy that as well. They enjoy it, but maybe on a different level. And I think that practice, meditation, studying, all that kind of thing is actually enjoyable. But it's a different kind of enjoyment from sensory enjoyment, from having the chocolate biscuits, or from having a cuddle, or from looking at the sunset, and all that kind of thing. I think what the message in here is that kind of thing is really important. Mm-hmm. It's fine to enjoy yourself. I think sometimes people get the sense that you've got to be very puritanical and deny yourself. But the story of Sariputta, even though he's a crybaby, but the city is the opposite of that. It's a place of happiness and fun and enjoyment. It's a safe place. It's a place where you can go shopping. So, interesting. Well, the time is nearly a quarter past. Do you want me to tell you what Dhammagata taught? I don't know how much sense you'll be able to make of it. But I could give you that, and then we can finish and see if there are any questions. Shall I do that? Ever Weeping, the Bodhisattva, he came prepared with a question, and his question was, for him, a very existential one, because I haven't filled in the whole story, but he has this vision of the Buddha, and then the vision vanishes. And of course, at first he's very inspired. He thinks, great, I know what to do now. I've got to travel 500 leagues in an easterly direction to the city of Gandakuti, and there I'll hear perfect wisdom. But as he goes along, he gets more and more puzzled. He thinks, But what was that experience I had? I had this vision of the Buddha. The Buddha, isn't around. It wasn't a real Buddha. But I had this really vivid vision of the Buddha actually telling me what to do, giving me a teaching. And he has this question formulated in his mind. Where did that image come from and where did it go to? So when he meets with Dharmagata, the Bodhisattva, this is what he asks. And this is the answer that Dharmagata gives. He says, the Buddha certainly did not come from anywhere and it didn't go anywhere. Because reality does not move and the Buddha is reality. Space doesn't come and go and the Buddha is like space. In fact, I'm paraphrasing this a bit shortly, but all experiences are like that. The suchness of things, the way things are, is like this. And the suchness of all experiences and the suchness of the Buddha are simply this one single suchness with no division. Suchness is, the word is tathata, and it means, roughly means, things being just as they are, if that makes any sense. So suchness is the philosophical word is the facticity of things, if that is a word you've heard before. This suchness is just as it is with no division. It's like a mirage, a conjuring trick or a dream. So don't hang on to the Buddha through his form. Don't hang on to the Buddha through the sound of his voice. Don't hang on to the Buddha through his name. And because of that, imagine that he comes and goes. The Buddha does not come and the Buddha does not go. Everything arises according to a collection of conditions. When those conditions exist, the thing arises. When those conditions cease, that thing passes away. It doesn't come from somewhere or go off somewhere else. And in the Buddha gives the example of pearls in the ocean. He says the pearls grow in the ocean through causal mechanisms. They don't come from somewhere. They don't go away to somewhere. They're destroyed, they're eroded by causal mechanisms as well. And similarly, the Buddha's body has arisen dependent upon causes and conditions. It's also like the sound of a lute, he says. In fact, in this translation, he says it's the sound of a boog harp. Bodhi Lila, what is a boog harp? Neither have I. I thought maybe you'd know as a musician. Well, let's call it a lute, because the description sounds more like a lute to me. I have no idea what a boog harp is. I don't know if maybe Dr. Konza, who did the translation, made up the word. What the Buddha says is, the lute sound doesn't come from anywhere or go anywhere. It's produced by the totality of its causes and conditions. It's produced by the hollow body, the sounding board, the strings, the neck, the bindings, and the plectrum. It's also produced by the person who's playing it and the effort that she's making while she plays it. They all work together to produce the sound. All of them are necessary. This is how you should view the coming and going of the Buddhas. This is how you should view the coming and going of all experiences. So that's the, in brief, I've abbreviated it, but that's the teaching that Dharmagata gives to sort of the first teaching. Then there's a gap, and he gives another teaching later on. So just to conclude, I want to, relate a bit to the city ourselves. You know, I've been talking about these historical examples of cities in ancient India. I've been talking about these archetypal cities, the ruined city of the Buddha's image, the mandala city of Gandavati. But we're living in London. We're living in the city here, aren't we? And if you consider London, the city you live in, and you also consider this sort of shimmering parallel London of your imagination, of the archetypal city, you can see where you can bring the two together. Bring the mandala city, the symmetrical city with a centre to it, together with the chaotic, noisy, dirty London, interpenetrating it, interpenetrating the real London. Imagine perhaps truth, if that's what you value, residing at the centre, perfect wisdom, truth, residing at the centre, resounding at the centre, like that Bodhisattva Dharmagata sitting on his teaching seat in the middle of the city. Visualize the mandala all around you. Can London be more like that for you? In other words, can London be invested with meaning or your own city, wherever that may be, can you feel that as you shift the centre of your experience, the centre of your awareness, is the centre of that city? There it is around you. You're looking for beauty. You're looking for recognition in other people. Feeling solid, feeling positive, feeling well-resourced, feeling surrounded by the circles of your friends and your family and your acquaintances, by the culture that is around you as well. You know, that's something which makes the city into a mandala, it seems to me. Your enjoyment, your sense enjoyment, your interests, your concerns, the contributions that you make, the gifts that you want to bring, the altruistic gifts that you might want to bring into this city through whatever your project is.